Good news on the job front.
The unemployment line is getting shorter.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Steve Chiatakis. It's the midday update from Marketplace.org. Today is Thursday, October 28th. In a moment, we're going to get some reaction to this morning's unemployment update from the Labor Department, the best number in months. And later, the Senate's been known as the Millionaires Club for years, but is that term really accurate? But first,
we found out from the Labor Department that the number of people who filed for first-time unemployment benefits last week fell by 21,000 to 434,000. That's the lowest level since July. Diane Swonk is chief economist at Mesirow Financial, and she's with us now from Chicago. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, first of all, Diane, this figure from the Labor Department, the number of new people filing for unemployment benefits dropped by 21,000 last week to 434,000. That's the lowest level since July. It sounds like pretty good news, is it?
Well, certainly when you lower the bar, it's easy to exceed it, and the bar has been lowered quite a bit. It is good news and welcome news that we're seeing a downward trend in unemployment claims. This is a highly volatile statistic, though, and in fact, last week's claims were revised up. Our moving average on claims is still over 450,000, which is still more consistent with an economy with the unemployment rate rising rather than falling.
And Diane, obviously the Fed is keeping a close eye on this number and the labor market in general. We heard yesterday about how much new money they might pump into the economy after their meeting next week. Do items like today's jobless claims number change the Fed's plans?
Well, they certainly don't change the commitment of Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke to try to do more for an economy that's still very fragile in its recovery. It's almost 16 months into a recovery now, so it doesn't change his commitment. But it is one of the factors, along with the naysayers within the Fed, that are actually trying to stop the Fed from moving further. And so it will mitigate the size of anything they do initially. They've already said it looks like it will be incremental change in their balance sheet, and they may do it for a long time, which could, you know, add up to be a lot, but initially, it's not this number, but in general, the backlash to the Fed's moving more within the Fed will keep them from going very aggressively at their start next week.
Okay, Diane Swonk, chief economist at Mesirow Financial. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Federal officials are expected to announce $2.5 billion in high-speed rail grants today. California is set to get the most money, with Florida close behind. But as Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports from the Sustainability Desk, not everybody in the railroad biz is celebrating.
President Obama has touted high-speed rail as a greener, faster alternative to cars. California's got the most ambitious plan, an 800-mile rail network running from San Diego to Sacramento, with trains traveling 220 miles per hour. John Robert Smith co-chairs the advocacy group Transportation for America.
We believe for the future, the people of the United States need choices for transportation, and high-speed rail is certainly one of those choices and an important choice for the future.
But many of these new trains will run at only 110 miles per hour and on the same tracks as freight rail. And freight rail companies aren't thrilled about sharing. Mark Reuter at the Progressive Policy Institute says they have a legitimate gripe.
There's a congestion problem. There's huge liability problems. Essentially, staying on existing freight lines is what the current system is today, which is Amtrak.
But building new designated tracks for all high-speed rail would cost billions more in public funding. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Wells Fargo says it's going to refile paperwork for 55,000 foreclosures. The bank says it's found problems with the documents. But it's not going to issue a blanket moratorium on foreclosures like Bank of America did briefly. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer joins us now live from Washington to talk about Foreclosure Gate and a new report on foreclosures that's out today. Good morning, Nancy.
Good morning, Jeremy.
Well, many of the early foreclosures in the crisis, as we know, had a lot to do with the bursting of the housing bubble. What are the reasons for this new wave?
Well, Jeremy, remember homeowners are continuing to lose their jobs, or maybe they're seeing their hours cut.
Right.
So they're falling behind on their mortgage payments. Now, the cities with the highest foreclosure rates are still in the states at the epicenter of the crisis. But as you mentioned, foreclosures in the Seattle area have increased. They're up 71% from last year. Chicago is up 35%. And things are just going to get worse. Foreclosures are expected to actually peak next year.
And is this at all related to Foreclosure Gate, the story we've been talking about with all these problems with paperwork?
No, actually. the foreclosure gate will cause foreclosures to actually dip slightly at the end of this year. And that's because some banks have frozen foreclosures so they can fix these paperwork problems, things like someone robo-signing stacks of documents without reading them. But Rick Sharga of Realty Track told me these problems will be resolved soon.
Probably by the second quarter of next year, the robo-signing issue, at least in terms of foreclosure activity, will be sort of a blip in the rearview mirror.
And Jeremy, Sharga says the state attorneys general who are investigating the foreclosure paperwork mess could levy fines or even file criminal charges. And Bloomberg is reporting a task force of attorneys general could meet with lenders as early as this week.
All right. We'll be following it. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer in Washington. Thanks.
You're welcome.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Thursday, October 28th. I'm Steve Chiotakis. For the latest look at the markets, check out our website, marketplace.org, and then go into the numbers section. Now to the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics around the world and how it affects us here in the United States. The Japanese carmaker Nissan today said it's recalling more than 2 million vehicles for an ignition switch problem. More than a third of those automobiles were sold in the U.S., and mostly trucks and SUVs are affected. The recall affects the Titan, Pathfinder, Xterra, Frontier, and Armada, along with the Infiniti QX56, made between 2003 and 2006. Hans Greimel is Asia editor for Automotive News. He's with us from Tokyo. Thanks, Hans, for being with us.
You're welcome.
What prompted this recall?
Well, there was a faulty ignition relay in these vehicles, and it can cause engine problems. Apparently, in the worst-case scenario, it can cause the engine to not ignite at all.
Are people, Hans, becoming desensitized to all these recalls? It seems like we hear about recalls all the time now. Are people sort of blowing them off and it's not such a big deal anymore?
Well, you know, 2010 has certainly been the year of the recall. We've seen recalls almost every other week here, it seems. But you're right. I think in some sense, people are becoming desensitized to recalls. That's partly because automakers now are being more proactive about initiating recalls. They're not waiting until the problem festers or waiting until an accident happens.
How is this going to affect Nissan? Haven't they had some financial problems in the past?
They have had some financial problems. They're coming back now and hoping to, make better earnings. So the impact of this will probably be more image-related, I would say, than financial-related.
Hans Greimel is Asia editor over at Automotive News. Hans, thanks.
Thank you.
European leaders meet at a special summit today on the future of Europe's finances. They're hoping to draw up plans to avoid a repeat of the Greek debt crisis. Those leaders are also trying to learn some lessons from the United States. From London, here's Marketplace's Europe correspondent, Stephen Beard.
Among the ideas under discussion today, what about a heavy fine on any of the 16 Eurozone member states that borrow too much? Or how about punishing reckless Eurozone countries by depriving them of a vote at summit meetings? Skeptics say even these radical solutions won't work. Just look at the US, 50 states operating as the world's biggest currency union. Unlike the US, though, Europe is not one country, and therefore it doesn't have a free flow of cash or labour between its richer and its poorer regions. Andrew Hilton of the CSFI think tank.
Different educational systems, different cultures, everything from different menus in the restaurants stop people moving from one country to another and really mean that there are 16 different countries within the Eurozone.
And he says while Californians may be prepared to bail out Nevada, the Germans will always be rather loath to help the Greeks, the Portuguese, or other countries in the Eurozone. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton has urged China to clarify its policy on rare earth metals. Those are the resources needed to make a lot of high-tech gadgets. China produces the vast majority of the world's supply of rare earths. And Secretary Clinton's remarks came after reports China curbed exports to the United States, Europe, and Japan. The BBC's Michael Bristow is with us this morning from Beijing. Hi, Michael.
Hi, good morning.
What is China's reaction to this?
Well, China's come out and basically denied that it's going to use rare earth metals as a bargaining tool. A spokesman for the Ministry of Industry said a few hours ago that basically they want to cooperate with other countries and export these rare earth metals so everybody can benefit from them. And it must be said, though, this is a little bit of a mixed message, because yesterday a foreign ministry spokesman said it was well within China's sovereign rights to control the flow of these rare earth metals outside the country.
And Michael, why are these metals so important? Why are we talking about this?
Well, they're used in a range of industries, both civilian industries and for military uses as well. And that's why people like the US Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is concerned, because without these metals, many industries won't be able to function, won't be able to produce things. But it must be said that America and many other countries do produce or have these rare earths themselves. They just stopped producing them some time ago. So perhaps if China continues to put a block on exports, or there's question marks over it, they ought to go back to mining them themselves or look for alternative ways to make these products.
The BBC's Michael Bristow in Beijing. Michael, thanks.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Midday Update for Thursday, October 28th. I'm Jeremy Hobson. Earnings are due out today from Coinstar. The company that owns Redbox has been adding thousands of their DVD rental kiosks, and sales numbers are expected to be up from last year. And now the distribution model is attracting interest from public libraries. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
So I'm outside a 7-Eleven near my office. The Redbox vending machine says $1 DVD rentals. Swipe my card, pick a title, and go from there.
So it's even more convenient where the DVDs come in the mail, because it's sort of instant gratification.
That's CNET executive editor Molly Wood, and she says vending machines are a natural fit for public libraries. Borrowers will jump at a service as convenient as Redbox and free. Libraries in Florida and Arizona are doing it. In Chicago, the library is exploring the idea of kiosks in transit stations, says spokeswoman Ruth Ledneiser.
You have kind of bestsellers, maybe some music CDs or some DVDs. You use your library card to swipe, and you return it to any of the branches.
CNET's Molly Wood would add one more thing.
A USB interface, and so you could plug in a Kindle or an iPad and download a digital book or check out a physical book. That would seem to be the killer app.
I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
In the midterm elections coming up next week, politicians are talking a lot about high unemployment, touting their plans to create jobs. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports employment these days is part function of policy, but also viability.
Brandon Clark's a vice president of an insurance agency. On the side, he helps run the website Knoxify, a hyperlocal website focused on Knoxville, Tennessee.
It's actually just a labor of love.
It's the sort of site where people post pictures of the city, reviews of the newest coffee shop, and the sort of hyperlocal site, growing in popularity, where everyone works for free. But could this be a workable model for journalism? Jan Schaefer from American University's JLab says it's early yet.
I think that one model of sustainability might well be a community site as an act of civic volunteerism.
It's that energy that has grown Knoxify over the last 3 years. Casey Peters works with Clark.
We wanted to leave the politics and crime to the general news outlets, and we just wanted to focus on kind of the hidden gems of Knoxville.
And Clark says when they need content, there's always someone who steps up.
You know what? I'd be happy to write for you. I don't have a journalism or J-school background, but I'd be happy to try and toss something together just to keep it going.
At the same time these self-described reporters have stepped up for free, paid reporters lost jobs during this recession on shrinking advertising. According to the American Society of News Editors, in the last decade, newsrooms have cut more than a quarter of their reporters. The number of paid journalists is expected to continue to fall. Jan Schaefer from JLab thinks major papers covering national and international news will continue to exist as they search for new revenue models online. But
I think we'll wind up with a variegated media ecosystem.
Some successful online groups exist, from investigative journalism to fact entrepreneurs who run their own sites. But right now, few web-based media projects make lots of money. In order for these sites to offer real jobs, they have to start making money to pay money, which is what Noxify is trying to do. They're looking for sponsors. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
With Election Day approaching in Florida, developers there are rushing to file applications for new construction projects. That's because there's an amendment on the Florida ballot that would give citizens a say on development projects in their communities. From WMFE in Orlando, Tom Parkinson reports.
Amendment 4 would give Florida voters a final say over any changes to their community's land use plans, and that has developers worried. The idea for the amendment surfaced last year. Since then, developers have filed twice as many applications for new construction. James Miller is a spokesman with the Florida Department of Community Affairs, which handles all development applications.
In our anecdotal conversations with planning officials at local governments around the state, the possibility of Amendment 4 passing was a common theme for the increase.
Supporters of Amendment 4 say it would put the brakes on suburban sprawl, but opponents argue it would cost taxpayers millions and drive away jobs. Wayne Garcia is with Hometown Democracy, a group promoting Amendment 4. He says Florida has a long history of development with little regard for environmental damage or the need for new roads or schools or other infrastructure.
If a project comes down the line and it goes through the entire process and it's not a good one, but because of political reasons, because of lobbyists, because of special interests, it gets approved, it's going to have one more step. And that added step is that the next election, the voters are going to vote on it.
Supporters say local governments will still have the final say over many, if not most, development projects. Any changes to the local comprehensive land use plans will have to go before voters. Ryan Houck is with Citizens for Lower Taxes and a Stronger Economy. He says Amendment 4 would require special elections at taxpayer expense.
There would almost certainly need to be special elections due to the volume of comprehensive plan amendments. Even if there aren't, delaying vital community needs like hospitals or schools for 2 years until a referendum can be held is extremely unworkable.
The $42 billion a year construction business is one of Florida's largest industries. In Orlando, I'm Tom Parkinson for Marketplace.
U.S. News and World Report has released a list of the meanest airlines in America. Think long lines, annoying fees, and general rudeness. Steve, guess who ranks number one?
You know, there are so few airlines left, so I could just do this by eeny,
exactly.
Meeny,
miny, moe.
Exactly.
There are probably about five of them. So.
I don't know.
It is Delta, which I know you fly because you like to go to places
go
in
to
the south.
Absolutely.
Exactly. It's number one in delays and consumer complaints.
All right. Who's next?
Well, United is a close second. Ah. And if you've flown on any airline recently, you won't be surprised to hear that the rest of the pack is pretty close behind. We've got the whole list up at marketplace.org.
And again, because there are so few airlines left, that list isn't very
exactly.
long.
Exactly.
Sure.
It doesn't take up much bandwidth on our site.
And finally, Roll Call says the Millionaires Club. You've heard this term, right? The Millionaires Club
sure.
in the Senate, Jeremy? It's only mostly millionaires. More than half of the senators there, 54 out of 100, according to the publication, have fortunes of more than $1 million.
Senator John Kerry remains the richest senator with a net worth of $188 million, which actually, Steve, is my net worth as well.
Yeah.
Four senators missed being in the club by only a small amount of money.
I'm talking just thousands of dollars, right?
Thousands of dollars.
Mere thousands of dollars. Perhaps, Jeremy, they can build their wealth as they go on and as they continue to represent the little guy.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. They're keeping in close touch with their constituents.
That's right. In Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiatakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
Be a billionaire, so freaking bad.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.